Jeremy, so good to have you again in Radio Evolve. We haven't talked for a while.
Yeah, it's good to be back, Thomas. Thanks for having me on.
And there's a good reason for having you on. You wrote a book about Jean Gebser. Your life work is very much about Jean Gebser, as you're also leading the Jean Gebser Society in the US. But not only that you wrote this book, it also came out, which is kind of fun, in German translation, where Jean Gebser's work started with. And it came out already nearly a year ago in German, I mean.
Yeah, just about a year ago. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's surreal. It's been that long already.
It took us a while, but we really wanted you because of the book now being available, and there is not so much scholarly work on Jean Gebser these days. So I really appreciate that you did that, and I really appreciate also Thomas Mark that they published this in the Phänomen Verlag. This is the book. Let me start from the beginning. Jean Gebser seems to be, if I may say so, beside that you have a wife and a kid, your love. How come?
Why Gebser? So I'm recently, I think as of a little over a year ago, no longer the president of the Gebser Society. I've passed the mantle on, but nevertheless, for many years I was helping to steward the conferences, and I think around, let's see, 2012, 2013, I had started getting involved with the conferences, and that moment was really me starting to feel like there was an intellectual journey I was on that I wasn't going to be getting off of. There was a train that I got onto with Gebser's inquiries and questions, particularly his connection to what he described as integral consciousness that, Ken Wilber draws from for his own schema, and time. And I haven't really seen a lot of other scholars in the evolution of consciousness field, generally speak about this connection between integral consciousness and time. And particularly for Gebser, time is this sort of multifaceted thing that could stand in for so many other things or relates to so many other things. Time is complexity, time is history and the history of consciousness, time is the presence of the future. There was just this endless creative fascination with how might Gebser apply to our present, because intuitively, at least, it started for me. There was this sense that time had everything to do with our present Anthropocene crisis, sort of the relationship between the burning of fossil fuels, which is a very ancient form of time, right? Literal fossil fuels from millions and millions of years ago, the activities of the present. The near recent activities of our ancestors from the past few generations, burning fossil fuels, and then the implications for the future. It seemed as if our predicament was profoundly temporal. So for me, Gebser's been prescient in the sense that his writing in the 1940s and 1950s, his thesis about integral consciousness and time seemed to be confirmed just by everything that we're going through in our own age. And now, of course, folks are talking about liminality and a time between worlds and metamodernism, right? So there's this sort of emphasis on delineations of epochs, but there's also an emphasis on time, like how are the times changing? What kind of time are we entering into? So I think for me anyway, Gebser was an endless journey into this question, right? He sort of opened the questions of the 21st century. And he was doing this back in the 19th century and 20th century, I mean. So that intellectual curiosity. And then I think the other aspect would be the poetics of his writing. And he's a dense writer, very Germanic, if I may say, like intellectual, challenging, thorough, meticulous. And yet, there is a poetics, there's a lightness to his writing that if you can really work with his style, there's certain moments of revelation that feel like spiritual transmission. And maybe that's no surprise because he was a poet before he was a scholar of consciousness evolution. So I would say those two things, Gebser's relationship and his thesis on time and integral consciousness, and then the sort of spiritual poetics in his writing has been a kind of spiritual resource for me as well, just in terms of coming back into the present, right? In an aesthetic and in a poetic sense, in a, as he calls his language for it, is senseful, right? In a senseful way, how do we return to the present? And what does the present contain, right? And there's the temporal question. For Gebser, it was, you know, the present is open as an open form of time that relates both to the past and the future in living relationship with us. And this is a statement, I feel like it has to be encountered first poetically, before we really begin to try to unpack what that might mean intellectually and conceptually. Does that make sense?
It makes very much sense. And I would say, and I'm curious what we think about it, particularly the poetic side that you're kind of emphasizing here, is very much related to the question of time. Because the way I understand him, and his thinking, it is also at least the attempt of a departure from modernity, what he calls mental stage. And in that, we have a certain relationship to time and a certain relationship to language that has something very clear, very linear, very logical, that Jean Gebser seems, both in the way he kind of thinks about what a new consciousness could be about, and the way he thinks about, seem to be necessarily linked. The rhythm of language, also kind of the poetic resonance field of language, that in modern language is more in the background because it's more the linear reasoning that basically builds the way how we perceive what is real and what is not real, seems to be both in what he tries to open up and in the way he does be a package that we have to kind of see as a whole.
Exactly. The Gebser's careful attention to language, he appreciated the efficacy of the appropriate word or series of words, just in terms of he described it, in at least in the translation of EPO, as seeking out the new statement. And what is the new statement? How do we convey and impart the new consciousness in language itself? How does language reflect the new consciousness and embody it? I think in English it's called synecdoche. You know, it's both a part of something and also an expression of the thing that it's talking about. It's an enactment of the thing it talks about or points to. And for Gebser, I think language had to become that. And primarily, you know, his interest in how he got started was looking at poets like Rilke and attempting to understand what the new relationships between subject and objects, verbs, the new kind of grammatology of the integral world, what it was. And it was mostly an aesthetic intuition, a poetic intuition, that Rilke had conveyed this sense of transparency in overcoming the boundaries between subject and object, or as he says, you know, overcoming that boundary between life and death in this principle of diaphaneity. This is, you know, very much Gebser's spiritual and poetic core. So I guess what I'm saying is the emphasis on language is primary for Gebser. Like, if we can't convey the new consciousness through our speech and our thinking, then we're not really embodying it quite yet. We're perhaps anticipating it. But he saw all of culture in the 20th century is sort of struggling with this new consciousness of time, struggling to articulate the new statement. And the poets as the individuals who were first able to reach it, you know, from Rilke to Milam to even just sort of the kind of romantic poetry of Novalis and Hölderlin. He sensed something going on in their language that was speaking to, again, the new statement, or as he calls it, the aperspectival world, a new relationship with time and a different relationship with creativity and the past. That's sort of a caveat, but we could get into that too. I'm studying that this week to prepare for my final class in the Gebser course right now. It's like we're going to deep dive into his commentary on poetry.
The timing. For this conversation, I mean.
For sure.
I mean, I understand the beauty of this, although it's also difficult language. But you made also a different point. You started the way at the relevance of this. You mm-hmm. seem to have a connection between some, if not maybe most of the major crises that we are in, which are a crisis of our relationship to time and Earth, how we in time relate to Earth. Mm-hmm. And if I hear you right, you're saying questioning our modern understanding of this of this relationship, and you also highlighted the subject object a part of this, is part of where we find answers. Can you expand a little bit how you think that Jean Gebser's thinking is helpful here?
Sure. Yeah, I think you know, part of the insight Gebser is able to generate as we engage with his work, he talks about our modern age is particularly reliant on that Cartesian subject-object divide, you know, standing apart from the world, and then applying what he says is a kind of partitioning activity, right? The way we know the world is through directive thinking, which he says in a similar language and perhaps in a similar meaning to Henri Bergson. We spatialize the world, right? We only know the world spatially and abstractly. We encounter the world that way, but there's nothing wrong with that intrinsically. But the problem with modernity is that we've been so one-sidedly fixated on spatializing and dividing the world and knowing the world through cutting it up and abstracting it. There's a kind of, as Gebser describes, a deficient move that's been going on in modernity. In the history of consciousness, the whatever relevant structure of consciousness that's predominant can enter into a deficient mode, which means it's emphasizing quantity over quality. It's moving into a kind of reductionism, a rigidity, or a fixation. And for Gebser, modernity he saw as predominantly fixated on spatializing, and this creates a kind of crisis because, for him, for Gebser, the world cannot be, in the ultimate sense, spatialized. We have to incorporate and understand time. And for Gebser, time isn't just chronological time. Time, for Gebser, is a lot more complex. Time involves somehow the qualitative. So rather than speaking about quantities of time or measured time, we also need to speak about intensities of time. To give one example, the French word temps, right? It means weather, but it also means time. There's a temperature to time, right? There's a quality of hot or cold. There's a senseful dimension to what Gebser called temporics that modernity had pretty much thrown out or disregarded. Now, the kind of crisis that comes about is if we're only spatializing the world, the unincorporated dimension of time is going to continue to press more intensively into our awareness and create crises for us where we're hapless to respond to, let's say, technological runaway progress. The sense that, you know, we can only have a one-sidedly growth-oriented economic system. It's a very much a sort of a directive spatial time. So for Gebser, the crisis centers around our capacity to whether or not we can really embrace time as quality. And from there, as he saw, you know, in the early 20th century, we had a kind of eruption of what we had been not incorporating into our culture and consciousness in terms of the eruption of the unconscious, the movements of surrealism and Dada and psychology kind of pointing to the irrational dimension. For Gebser, he saw this as a kind of temporal breaking in of a new consciousness by an incorporation of time as the past. But for Gebser, that's not enough. It's not sufficient to merely incorporate the unconscious and time as a kind of irrational quality. For Gebser as well, there is a sense that time is wholeness. Time is a relational whole, that in the living present, the past and the future are here. The dead and the unborn are co-present. So part of the crisis in the 20th century has been a kind of implosion of modernity's spatial world. Let's say, you know, he brings the example with technology and how in the mid 20th century, at least, we saw these rapid innovations, right? The collapsing of the spatial world by radio and the sort of technologies that supersede spatial distances, right? But then there's also these runaway forms of time, like technological progress, runaway capitalism. And in our time, we have the sort of penultimate crisis right now of climate, right? Which is a very temporal phenomenon, as I was mentioning before. It entangles us in the past and the future as a lived reality. And to the degree that we don't intuitively understand time as a relational whole, we will continue to sort of suffer the intensification of time breaking through into our awareness and the modern world continuing to implode upon itself and deconstruct itself. You know, one of the phenomena Gebser talks about, this is maybe the one part that kind of got me hooked with Gebser over, let's see, 15 years ago or so, more so as I began to study the text. He talks about the perspectival world's tunnel vision. It's sectorizing of the Cartesian subject object, sort of imploding so that it becomes a sort of universal deconstruction, right? We no longer have a shared ground or common ground to stand on. Everybody has their little plight, their little point of view. And the world kind of, you know, in Gebser's critique of modernity, begins to sort of implode upon itself. So everybody has a fragmented view. No one's able to talk with anyone anymore. And I believe Steiner called this a war of all against all. And he saw this as sort of the direction where modernity was headed, where the perspectival world was headed. Mm-hmm. So we needed a new ground. There needs to be a new shared sense of reality, a way to connect with one another again. And for Gebser, it's time. And it's time in this more multifaceted qualitative sense that brings us out of ourselves, brings us out of the Cartesian ego, and allows us to connect with one another again, have a shared sense I want to say reality, but a shared sense of world might be a better way of putting it. It's a relational world, but it's a temporal one.
Let's go into these particular qualities of time as you're unfolding them. One that stuck with me is the mentioning of the intensity of time, which is interesting to just point to that, because all of a sudden, when you let that in, possibility of something like the intensity of time, it seems to me that time in itself, our understanding of it, immediately becomes multidimensional. Something that we usually don't look in this category. That there's something where I appreciate intensity, where all of a sudden something that is only two-dimensional or maybe even one-dimensional, I don't know, becomes three or four-dimensional in contemplating that. And then I can't remember which exactly word you used, but basically the presence of the before and the not yet in the presence. Mm-hmm. So there's something, and Jean-Gebser also uses the term, and at least that's the way I would understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the transparency of time, mm-hmm. is that the quality of presence is full of the not yet and full of the not anymore. And to appreciate that, the presence becomes something that holds all of that. The ever-present origin, the title, which, funny enough, I like the English title better than the German title. That's something that speaks more directly to what I'm really excited about when I think about Jean-Gebser, although it's in the Ursprung und Gegenwart also present, but it's ever-present origin. The way I hear it and understand it is to allow, I don't find a better word, the transparency in all directions, to kind of come together, and then find a way where it relates to life and earth from this multi-perspectival our transparency of the presence that we are sharing together. Does this in any way for you as a Gebserian make sense?
Oh, completely, completely. Yes, the Gebser's term for that, the present having both what is no longer and then also what may be or what could possibly be, it's latency. He calls it, his term for it is latency. Like things return to latency in the sense that the past is, it remains in us and it remains effective to some degree, even if we're not conscious of it. And the future is also latent in that there are forms of becoming that are in us, right? That are unfolding, again, whether or not we're aware of that. So the past and the future are latent in the present. They're contained in the present. And the present for Gebser, when we're speaking about integral time or integral consciousness in the human being, this is experienced as he calls transparency or diaphaneity, diaphanon, right? Through seeing through phenomena, in terms of the Greek etymology. So there's a shining through of phenomena. And the way he describes it poetically, he says, time is open and the present is open. And it's accessible to us. And so the integral mutation or the integral structure is contingent, or its actualization is contingent on us turning towards the present, right? And discerning in our own perception, with our own senses, the openness of time, the latency of the past and the future in the spiritual present. So for Gebser, in a lot of ways, it's a very complicated text, but as you're pointing to, Algis McCunis, who's one of the translators of the English version of Ever-Present Origin, he said something to that effect the simplicity of the title, right? Ever-Present Origin is just, that's the whole book in itself. Why do we need to go any further than that? That's the book. And I think Rudolf Hammerly has also spoken about that as well, the kind of spiritual koan-like nature of the title of the book itself. Origin is ever-present. And for Gebser, it's a spiritual phenomenology in the sense that, for Gebser, at least, I think biographically and personally, he experienced the spiritual present or origin in the present, which is ever originating. The way he begins the book is to say, origin is not a beginning. It's before the beginning, but it's also shining through past, present, and future. Origin is ever present. So it's a very interesting insight that we can sort of meditate on. But if we can at least intuit it, we can get a bit of a sense of what Gebser means by time freedom, or integral time. He uses these words interchangeably: time freedom, open time, the integral mutation. For Gebser, when origin becomes conscious in the human being, when the ever-present origin becomes conscious in us and we become conscious of it, as it were, that's the integral mutation, kind of coming online. We can also call it a kind of interiorization of the originary present in the human subjectivity and intersubjectivity. And in turn, a kind of crystallization, like a moving through and in the world from that state of being, that open state of being. So for Gebser, a lot of this has to do with overcoming, again, that Cartesian sense of the ego, the sense of self-separateness, or Charles Taylor's description of the buffered self, right? How do we overcome the buffered self? It's through this integral mutation that Gebser's speaking to.
Let me hone in on this for a moment and play it back to you. Let's see if that makes sense. Because the way I hear you, the liberation of time in that, I hear it in this way, just that our, let's call it modern Cartesian relationship to time has something contracted in a punctual identity that is our individual essence that has a coming from and going to, but is completely identified in this mechanics from to here. And the transparency that you / Gebser are talking about is to let go of this punctual identification with this I sense and allow to see through the world through a sense where the origin and also the latent future are kind of informing that it's a kind of a kaleidoscopic new prisma that the way appears in, which changes this fixed idea. I am the so and so born that time, or biography and whatever. There's something coming from all sides in and in. Forming itself. That seems to be central to what this different relationship to time is about.
Yes, very much. You know, a lot of folks in our communities talk about the spiritual term non-duality. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I know it's used quite a lot, but I think with Gebser, the term does apply, but it doesn't have to do with just space. He has a poem called the Winter Poem, which is quite a beautiful text he wrote in the mid-40s in a period of 45 minutes in one sitting. And one of the stanzas in the poem is saying something to the effect that, you know, all of the distant stars are in us, right? There's no boundary, there's no separation between us because all of the stars flow through our veins. So there is this overcoming of space, but I think the important thing as well is that it's the overcoming of time as the divider, time as past, present, future, that there's a non-dual approach to both time and space in Gebser's work. And exactly what you're describing, this kind of kaleidoscopic, dynamic, relational present, where there's still a center or a locus, like there's still a self, but the self becomes a bit more permeable, a bit more transparent, to use Gebser's term, diaphanous, in relation to time and space. So it's a coming back into relationship, I would say, with the spiritual present. And the ego is overcome, but it's not undone or dissolved. One of Gebser's personal anecdotes when he's writing a letter about his own experience in Sarnath in the early 60s, having perhaps a kind of, in his correspondence with D.T. Suzuki, Suzuki described it as potentially a Satori experience, but Gebser sees it as very much, you know, the integral structure he was speaking to, and he describes it as a sober, lucid clarity, but a kind of transubstantiation of the world where everything has changed and nothing has changed. There wasn't a state of ecstasy or rapture or self-dissolving. He was still present, and yet the self was transparent to origin. The world was transparent to origin. The appearances were saved, as it were, but they became translucent. They became shining through with that originary present. So I think this is important too, because we might, one of the moves that we make very often in this culture is to kind of look for ego dissolving experiences as the key. And for Gebser, he's saying, no, the integral mutation incorporates all of the unfolding history of humanity, right? It doesn't undo, it incorporates it somehow and renders it transparent.
But that allows me to pose a question that I wanted to bring into the conversation, because this sounds all very beautiful, but if I may say in a very prosaic way, how does this relate to fossil fuel?
Perfect. Yeah. There's a great line from a Andreas Malm book. He's a contemporary scholar on the history of fossil fuels, in his text, In the Progress of This Storm. And he's speaking about climate collapse and climate transition. And, you know, there's a particular passage that I sort of referred to earlier where, you know, in this passage, Malm is describing the ancient reservoirs of oil, right, that were digging up from the ground that are millions of years old, that point to another time in the biosphere, a whole ecosystem long gone, but it's still present. There's the burning of the fossil fuels in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, right? The industrial revolution, right? Those modes of the past, of our near ancestors, are present here and now whenever there's an odd storm, right? Whenever there's a little bit too much rain in the season, whenever we have a little bit larger of a more intensive a storm, the past is efficacious and present in the sense that it's showing up now. It's entangled in the weird weather we're experiencing, mm-hmm. the climate destabilizations. That's a temporal phenomenon. In a more prosaic or perhaps like literal sense of Gebser's insight into time and the integral consciousness for us, are predominantly the crisis has to do with a kind of time. Andreas Malm concludes this passage by saying, you know, the fossil fuels that are burning from our near ancestors showing up as extreme storms and extreme weather in our present. And then the burning of fossil fuels today entangled in the next few generations and how this century's unfolding. This is all a temporal phenomena. As Malm says, the air is heavy with time. And time shows up, I think, for us as an anxiety about time, as our, in my recent writing, I talk about how there's a sense of anxiety and guilt in this relationship with time, because we know we're living in a new time. We know there needs to be a transformation. We know the era of modernity and its extractive mentality with globalization and fossil fuels is already over. And yet we don't know how to live the new time. So I would say that everything, our entire predicament in the Anthropocene with the climate crisis is predominantly a temporal phenomena. Again, more in the more material, cultural, phenomenological sense, it's a challenge of time, and it's demanding and requiring a new attitude with respect to how we see these mm-hmm. feedback loops and ecological relationships, and how we see or don't see a longer view of both history and our impact on the future. Right? We don't have a very extended temporal horizon. We're very much, again, in the process of, you know, the mental perspective of a world, having that triangular conal vision, that tunnel vision. We have a very tunnel vision orientation towards the present. We're not really looking ahead. But the present, the future is sort of looming heavier and heavier and heavier on us today. And I think Gebser would point right at that and say, there we go. There's time showing up again in its negative and destructive sense. It could show up in a constructive and creative sense if we actually started thinking with time and allowing our thinking and our cultural activity to be more relational, right? And more future oriented in the sense of doing work in the present, knowing it has an entangled relationship with the future, and acting as if, you know, the future is here and now, and that we have an audience, right? They're looking back at us. that relationship, I think, could be a more constructive and positive one.
And the way you're describing the word present moment also changes its connotation, because the way you express yourself, there is the resonance of the past and the resonance of the to come as part of this present moment. So it changes the experience of what we are talking about, and we're talking about present moment because it's not separate, it is entangled for real, and at the same time it's also not kind of a history out there when we started to use fossil fuel, or when the original forests became coal in a way. There is no outside inside distinction in the in the same way, and I struggle to express that. But I have a clear experience how this changes the awareness of presence, and how it is also relevant to the way we act in this, because we act from a different perspective.
Exactly. We start to again, act as if we not only have an audience, but we're in relationship with people, like a people of the future. And we're in a relationship with ancestors in a very profound way. It's strange and uncanny to imagine, but it's probably the most realistic and existential way of thinking about the present we could possibly have, that our ancestors are showing up as the strange storms, right? The activities of our most recent past are showing up in the most lived material ways, if that makes sense. But that could transform into something that is spiritual, creative, honoring the future. You know, Joanna Macy has practices talking about the, you know, seven generations ahead and seven generations back, and working in a kind of an imaginative exercise of dialoguing with the past and dialoguing with the future, the ancestors and the unborn. That kind of relationship with time could be, or I would say there's an urgency for that to be realized, right? There's an intensity or a demand that the conditions of the world are putting on us now to actualize this new relationship with time. And Gebser writes about it in a kind of prophetic way. And I mean that in an almost biblical sense, in that there's a sort of a warning, right? If we don't actualize this mode of time, then time will fulfill us, right? We will be fulfilled in time, meaning we will, you know, be undone by this temporal reality we're situated in, rather than fulfill time in the sense of creatively realizing that temporal relationality and transparency as both our individual subjectivity, our cultural intersubjectivity, and our civilizational actions, right? What are our practices or cultural practices that are in accord with that mode of time? This would be, you know, again, I think that the most material existential way of reading Gebser is this temporal phenomena being front and center, the core of our Anthropocene crisis, and also the most grounded way of thinking about the future. Like, how do we act? Like, what are the ways in which we can be more relational and intuitively in accord with the past, the present, and the future?
It seems to me the way you're explaining Jean Gebser, that he is a key to understanding what we call our time. There's something, because of the pressing nature of our time and all kind of different parts of the meta crisis we can point to, but maybe if we stay with the climate crisis, maybe the most fundamental one, and how it relates to our capacity to kind of transcend the kind of acting that brought us here, and see that it is it's a certain perspective of acting that brought us here. And to understand this is a liberation, because you can see there's a different way of experiencing also the disaster that we are in, and acting out of a different perception of how we see presence in the context of what comes out of the past and comes in from the future at the same time, which I find, if I may say it, politically relevant. It's political consciousness work. It's something that maybe we, all of us, every single one has to meditate, if I may say it this way, as a political practice. Because it's this place that really allows us to find a different way of dealing with what we have to deal with.
Exactly. To be present, I think is I make this connection in my new book that I'm working on, Fragments of an Integral Future, but to practice becoming present and slowing down, right? To really be with the present is quite a radical act. Radical meaning the etymology of rad, right? Radical is root and origin. So there's a kind of originary radicality here in turning towards the present, in having a new relationship with time. There's a very short passage in Ever Present Origin where Gebser makes this point that, you know, if we truly embrace this new time, the whole world would transform. It's a political action. It's a radical world transforming activity to slow down and have this integral relation with time would mean we wouldn't have this kind of one-sided directedness of our economy, of technological progress, right? There would be a profoundly new relationship with our world, and our world would change accordingly if we truly lived according to this new time, this integral time. And I think it's very true. And every time a particular crisis shows up, we're talking about the climate crisis or fossil fuels, I describe them in my book Fragments as fragments from this ever-present future, emissaries from the future that are showing up as teachers because they're challenging us, right? They're challenging us to have a different relationship with time. And the only way we do that is a kind of intensification of consciousness and culture in the direction that Gebser is speaking of. But another element with that, of course, would be the sense that, you know, this radical slowing down is a spiritual practice. It's a way, and it's a necessary way. There's no way to abstractly concretize the integral. It has to be concrete. It has to be embodied and present. So this is sort of it's a contemplative injunction, but as you're pointing to, there's a kind of political invitation here too, to live in a very different way, to live in accord with origin and the planet and the present. I quite like Bruno Latour, a scholar who I think recently last year passed away. But he's one of these thinkers that are talking about biopolitics, or he calls it the new Gaian regime, which sounds a bit authoritarian, but he doesn't mean it that way. He means, I think Gebser would read him as quite a perspectival thinker, in the sense that he talks about being terrestrial bound, turning back towards the planet, facing Gaia is one of his sort of turn of phrases. And shifting our relationship with the planet from the globe of longitude and latitude, right? Again, a very mental perspectival dividing up of the world, to, as he calls, these intermediary zones of relationship, right? Critical zones. So there's a lot of intuitive ways we can begin to imagine this. And I think particularly the Gaian politics or biopolitics of the present are very much a kind of temporal phenomenon in a Gebserian sense. How do we relate differently? Time, economy, ecosystems. How do we be in accord with Gaia?
Jeremy, allow me to take this also as our final word. Thank you so much for this time.
Oh, thank you, Thomas. This was wonderful. Let's do it again sometime.